Welcome to Sojourner Truth. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. Today on our weekly roundtable, Trump and his allies step up their race and class warfare with a newly released Trump Care bill to repeal and replace Obamacare while providing billions in tax breaks for the rich. And analysis of the electoral loss of the Democrats in last Tuesday's election. Where do the Democrats go from here? Also, the latest on Trumpgate and the stepped up U.S. military attacks in Syria and U.S. support for isolating Qatar by the Gulf states as Trump and the Gulf states make moves against Iran. Race and immigration, the elephant in the room, impacting all of U.S. politics. Our panelists are Laura Carlson, Jackie Goldberg, and Dr. Gerald Horn. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. Now for our news headlines.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Eileen Alfandary. Republican Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell finally took the wraps off his plan to undo the Affordable Care Act known as Obamacare.
Because Obamacare isn't working, by nearly any measure, it has failed, and no amount of 11th hour reality denying or buck passing by Democrats is going to change the fact.
Donald Trump tweeted his support late in the day, saying he's very supportive of the Senate bill, quote, "Look forward to making it really special. Remember, Obamacare is dead," Trump tweeted. McConnell faces a challenge passing his measure. Shortly after the 142-page bill was distributed, more than half a dozen Republican lawmakers signaled concerns or initial opposition. Four senators said it didn't go far enough in dismantling Obamacare. Other Republicans expressed concern about the deep cuts to Medicaid, the health care system for low-income people, mainly children, people with disabilities, and the elderly. The bill would phase out the extra funds the Affordable Care Act provides to states that have expanded coverage under Medicaid. The additional funds would continue through 2020 and be gradually reduced until they're entirely eliminated in 2024. Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren said the Senate measure went even farther than the House bill in gutting Medicaid.
For Senate Republicans, it wasn't enough that the House bill was going to toss grandparents out of nursing homes or slash funding for people with disabilities or pull the plug on health care for babies born too soon. Now, Senate Republicans wanted to go bigger.
Nearly four dozen disability rights activists with the group ADAPT were arrested in a protest outside McConnell's office as he unveiled the legislation. They chanted against cuts to Medicaid.
No cuts to Medicaid! Save our no.
Besides undoing the Medicaid expansion, the Senate plan would reduce subsidies now provided to help people without workplace coverage get private health insurance. The bill would let states get waivers to withdraw coverage requirements under the current law, such as mental health, emergency, and maternity care. The Washington Post is reporting that President Obama received highly classified information last August with bombshell information that detailed Russian President Vladimir Putin's direct involvement in a cyber campaign to disrupt and discredit the presidential race. Post reporter Adam Entis appeared on CNN. He said the report was drawn from sourcing deep inside the Russian government.
This intelligence arrived by courier from the CIA in the first week of August. It was provided to a small group of the president's top advisors and to the president himself. Once they finished reading the intelligence, they were told to give it back to the courier so the courier can take it back to Langley. And inside the package was basically information from such an important source that it was almost as if they were seeing directly Putin's instructions on what to carry out here.
The Post says the intelligence captured Putin's specific instructions to defeat or at least damage Hillary Clinton and help elect Donald Trump. The Post reports that Obama was worried if he took action in response, Russia might launch a cyber assault on voting systems before and on Election Day. Donald Trump says he was just trying to keep fired FBI Director James Comey honest with his tweet, implying there might be recordings of their private conversations. Trump tweeted yesterday he never made and doesn't have recordings of his private conversations with Comey. Comey testified he told the president in multiple conversations he wasn't personally under federal investigation and said the president begged him to make that public. Comey also testified that Trump asked him for loyalty, which Trump denies. In the San Francisco Bay Area, the BART, Bay Area Rapid Transit System, has adopted what effectively is a sanctuary policy. It says BART will not cooperate with federal immigration agents unless required to do so by a state or federal court order or law. Directors changed the name of their policy from sanctuary to safety in a bid to guard against a potential cutoff of federal funds. BART Director Latifa Simon proposed the measure, saying 500,000 undocumented immigrants live in the San Francisco Bay Area, and many depend on BART.
For the Honduran mother that I talked to, who cleans rooms in downtown San Francisco, who catches BART four times each week to meet with her pro bono immigration attorney, to the young Somali sister who wears a hijab, who told me in researching the subject that she fears every single time she sees a BART police officer that she may be taken off the train. We know that this is not true, but I would love to say to them today, we want you to do two things: pay your fare and get to your destination safely, because that is our job.
BART joins many cities and counties in California and around the country which have adopted sanctuary policies against cooperating with immigration agents to round up undocumented immigrants. I'm Eileen Alfandari. You're listening to Sojourner Truth on Pacifica Radio.
This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth, and I would like to welcome our panelists for our weekly roundtable back today. I'd like to welcome Laura Carlson, political analyst and writer based in Mexico. She's written extensively on NAFTA, the drug war, immigration, and gender issues in America's Updater, Counterpunch, Fortune, and others. She's a columnist for the Huffington Post, Foreign Policy in Focus, and she's a commentator on NPR, Al Jazeera, BBC, Mexican television, and radio stations. She has participated as an analyst and activist in the movement against militarization and the drug war on both sides of the border, and is host of the Mexican television program Juecho en America. And Laura, welcome.
Thank you, Margaret.
Jackie Goldberg, who's served in the California State Assembly, also served as a member of the Los Angeles City Council, as a member of the Los Angeles School Board, and also chair of the Los Angeles School Board. She's currently working on contract with the mayor's office in Los Angeles to help with his plan called Service and Workforce Restoration, a program whose goals are to hire 5,000 permanent city employees by 2018. To restore service that was cut or curtailed by layoffs. Jackie has been an educator all of her life. Her early days came out of the free speech movement at UC Berkeley and the anti-war movement that broke out there. Jackie Goldberg, welcome.
Thanks for inviting me.
Dr. Gerald Horn is the Morris Professor of History and African American Studies at the University of Houston. He's published more than 30 books, including most recently Confronting Black Jacobins, the U.S., the Haitian Revolution and the Origins of the Dominican Republic, and Paul Robeson, the Artist as Revolutionary. At this year's 2017 National Council of Black Studies Conference, Dr. Horn was granted the Ida B. Wells and Sheik Anta Diop Award for outstanding scholarship and leadership in Africana studies, an award well deserved. Dr. Gerald Horn, welcome.
Thank you for inviting me.
Today, I also want to really give props to our panelists and to explain to our audience, I can't tell you how difficult it is to find a panel, to find one person, much less three, who are able to discuss with great thought and analysis just about any topic that comes up in the news. A lot of people become specialized in a particular area, and it's very, very difficult to find the panel with this range. So I just want to give them some props and to say how much our listeners, I hear all of the time, how much they appreciate our weekly roundtable and our panelists. So thank each and every one of you for just the work that you do in keeping up with everything, and just also for making that available to our audience. We're going to start off today on the Senate healthcare bill. Thursday, Senate Republicans unveiled their healthcare bill, one they'd been working on behind closed doors for quite some time. The bill, called the Better Care Reconciliation Act, maintains the essential structure of the House's unpopular American Healthcare Act, which, according to an NBC poll, 3-1 dislike that House bill. The Senate's bill has a system of federal tax credits to help people buy health insurance, yet the health insurance will not be required to cover maternity care, emergency services, and mental health treatment due to a provision that allows states to drop those and other benefits. These are benefits that had been provided by the Affordable Care Act, known as Obamacare. The bill repeals most of the tax increases put in place by Obamacare to pay for expanding coverage, putting money back into the pockets of the rich, while making huge cuts to Medicaid, a program that helps 1 in 5 people in the United States and almost 2/3 of people in nursing homes. This, according to the New York Times. Former President Barack Obama has called the bill a massive transfer of wealth, saying, quote, it hands enormous tax cuts to the rich and to the drug and insurance industries, paid for by cutting health care for everybody else. Simply put, if there's a chance you might get sick, old, or start a family, this bill will do you harm, end of quote. Let us go now, before we have our panelists weigh in, to a clip we are going to hear from the New York Times reporter Margot Sanger-Katz on how Republican plans to cut Medicaid would change healthcare as we know it.
I think this bill could potentially represent the largest change in a federal entitlement program, maybe in the history of the country. This would be taking away a program that has existed for 50 years and changing it into a very different structure. Medicaid is the country's largest government health insurance program. It covers about 74 million Americans, 4 out of 10 of every American children. 50% of all children who are born are covered by Medicaid. There are more than 10 million Americans with disabilities. 2/3 of all Americans who live in nursing homes are being paid for by the Medicaid program. There are also many millions of people in America who are just poor, and Medicaid is helping them pay for treatment for opiate addiction or for chronic disease care or just for basic checkups. Most of the Medicaid dollars actually don't go to poor Americans. Even if you're a middle-class person now with a lot of savings, you end up needing nursing home care that's $100,000 a year. If you're a person who has a child with a disability, now or in the future, care for a child like that can be extremely expensive and difficult to cover with commercial insurance. Medicaid is the program that cares for those people. Medicaid is run a little bit differently in every state, and it often has a different name. So a lot of people who are covered by the Medicaid program may not even realize that Medicaid is where they get their insurance. What Obamacare did is expanded Medicaid to cover more Americans by saying that everyone in every state who earned less than about $16,000 a year could become eligible for Medicaid if their state wanted to expand. About 31 states did, and so it's been a very large expansion of health insurance coverage to low-income Americans. It's pretty clear that there are going to be two really large changes to Medicaid as part of this bill. One, it cuts way back on the money that's available to states to cover this new expansion population. The other big change is more consequential but has received less attention, is that it will change the way that the federal government pays for all of the people who get Medicaid. It would essentially put the federal part of that spending on a diet. Some independent estimates suggest that the cut could be as much as 1 in 4 federal dollars that states are getting now they would no longer get. You should care about this because Medicaid is a big program that serves a lot of people, and it may serve you one day.
All righty. And Laura Carlson, starting with you, and also a view from being outside of the United States. I know when I travel around, people are shocked by the lack of health care as a right in the United States. The United States touts itself as the world's wealthiest nation, as the leader, you know, in democracy, that should be an example for others. And I know my little island nation of Barbados provides healthcare as a right. Okay. You have Cuba providing healthcare as a right. And here, this latest salvo, really an attack on impoverished people, on people with disabilities, on older people in the United States. Laura Carlson, your thoughts here.
That's right. In almost all other nations, healthcare and just basically taking care of the population is a barometer of the compassion of the society and also the effectiveness of a government. And here we have a healthcare proposal that is downright cruel. Besides that, it aims at the two poles of the demographics in the United States, at the young, who the statistic was given that 4 out of 10 children are on Medicaid and could be affected both in terms of their health, in terms of their intellectual and social development, their entire lives. There would be effects for generations to come. And then, of course, the old, with 2/3 covered in nursing homes, which is, again, a measure of how well people take care of the elderly, is a measure of how compassionate a society is. You have also direct consequences of the abandonment of many of the other sectors. We know from the Reagan experience that when the mentally ill are abandoned, they become homeless, they become defenseless within the communities, and we're still dealing with what happened when there was an attack basically on the mentally ill from there. It's also a test of Trumpism in Congress, and again, one of the most important. The question is, are Republicans really going to follow him off this political cliff? Now, of course, we have to watch to make sure that if it passes, there's accountability, to make sure that all voters know when they lose their health coverage, this happened because of your representative's vote, because there'll be a lot of attempts to spin it in some way, to say, yay, we got rid of Obamacare, and then when the consequences come down, to say, oh, well, but that part's not our fault somehow. So it's very drastic. It's a hideous measure. It's a terrible path to see the United States going down. And, of course, it's a blatant call for inequality. The Tax Policy Center says the top 0.1% of earners, people who make almost $4 million a year, would receive a tax cut of more than $200,000 immediately. That doesn't make any sense.
And Jackie Goldberg, you also see a lot of posturing. I mean, you know, on the mainstream media, there's a lot of discussion of people saying, oh, the bill is in some trouble. You have 4 conservative senators, you know, saying that they have problems with the bill. And of course, some of the moderate wing of the Republican Party, a number of them women who also have some problems. But it really remains to be seen if this is possible. Posturing of people really just trying to get some deal of some particular issue. I mean, the whole thing of the opiates, the concern about the level of addiction in the United States, the opiate addiction. I might add that when crack cocaine and heroin is decimating South Los Angeles and Harlem and other communities, there was no such concern as there is now about addiction. And of course, there should be concern about it. But, you know, maybe some dollars will be thrown in for that and draw people in line. What, first of all, your thoughts on this devastating bill, but also the politics of what's going on now? And do you think it's going to get through? And the Republican women like Susan Collins, Murkowski, and others, are they going to hold the line or cave? Your thoughts, Jackie Goldberg?
Well, I agree with the Oregon senator who said that the House bill was mean, but the Senate bill is meaner. Because remember, 30% of all adults with disabilities rely on Medicaid. Okay, 30%. That means millions of people who really only have one source of ability to stay mobile, to be not wheelchair bound in a house that's a medical. Not a medical, but a housing facility. So, you know, that's why the first demonstrations were done by people in wheelchairs yesterday outside of McConnell's office. Having said that, there's also a provision that says for 1 year, no money can go to Planned Parenthood. Now, that sounds like, oh, boy, the Republicans are really thrilled. But, you know, a lot of Republicans aren't thrilled because it provides a lot of the rural health care in rural parts of Maine, in rural parts of Montana, in rural parts all over the country. Planned Parenthood is the only health care clinic that is open in some of those places because they're too small to have enough income for hospitals. So you're talking about cutting health care dramatically, opportunities for it, for a full year. It also says that if a health plan provides abortion coverage, you cannot use a federal subsidy to buy it. Well, that means that all kinds of health insurers that now provide abortion coverage will get rid of it. All of these things lead to us understanding that basically, I think Alan Grayson was right, that the Republican plan is don't get sick, or if you get sick, die quickly, because I think that's what we're talking about here. 49% of all births in America, and there are about 10,000 live births in America every day, 49% of all live births are paid for by Medicaid. 39% of all children in the entire country. That's, you know, like almost 40%, 4 out of 10 children in the entire country are covered by Medicaid. That's an incredibly large number of children that will probably lose insurance. 76% of all poor children are covered by Medicaid. So what we're really saying is that we're going to save the rich and save corporations and save people. They're going to eliminate the 3.8% tax on investments. All of the people who have all of the money will get big, 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 big cuts in their taxes. And as a result, but they're smart, they think. They're not doing most of this until after the 2018 and 2020 elections. I think they're counting on Americans being too stupid to know that they're about to get clobbered. And that they'll just keep reelecting Republicans because they've kept their promises. Now, here's an interesting promise. One of the things that Trump said repeatedly throughout the campaign was that he wasn't going to cut Social Security, he wasn't going to cut Medicare, and he wasn't going to cut Medicaid. How he can reconcile this with that is really going to be an interesting thing. Finally, I think they do have trouble in the Senate, because they can only lose 3 votes. And I assume that the 4 reactionaries are going to vote for this. They're just going to get a little bit more cuts into Medicaid, maybe sooner, maybe deeper. I don't know how they could be much deeper. But what you're going to do is you're going to begin to see rural people who have large rural needs for medical care be very, very concerned who are Republicans, because they're going to end up with no medical care at all available in some parts of this country. And that will be an extremely devastating result.
Yes, and thank you for that, Jackie Goldberg. And of course, as you and Laura have said, this Republican health care bill will leave millions of people without health insurance. And I was really pleased and heartened and encouraged to see the protesters on the Hill, people with disabilities from the organization ADAPT, many of them in wheelchairs, living with disabilities, many elderly, and they did civil disobedience and were arrested at a sit-in outside and inside Mitch McConnell's office on Thursday morning, where they chanted, "Don't touch Medicaid," and also said that the bill would be a death sentence for some people with disabilities. And for a lot of people, that's serious about people dying. And police grabbed some of people from their wheelchairs and carried them down the hallway where they continued to chant. It was just absolutely encouraging to see. But I was discouraged that the only ones up on the Hill, it seemed, doing that kind of, you know, civil disobedience and making their presence strongly felt were people with disabilities. And you wondered, where were other people who are going to be impacted by this? But Dr. Gerald Horn, as you weigh in on this, I saw a tweet that somebody said that if somebody says air that we breathe is free and a right, that some people will oppose it because Black people and brown people are going to be able to breathe the air, even if it kills them, right? And I thought that was really quite telling. And Dr. Horn, it reminded me the story of that John Bracy tells during World War II about the white blood and black blood, and that some of the soldiers who were injured in the war, that they literally had to carry around blood that was black and blood that was white, and that some of the white people refused, even though they were injured, to get, quote unquote, black blood, even though, of course, obviously there's no difference. But Dr. Horn, your thoughts on all of this?
Well, I think that you have revealed why this abomination of a bill might receive support from the base of the Donald J. Trump coalition. That is to say that often our friends on the left torture the numbers till the numbers confess that Donald J. Trump has a dearth of working class and middle class support, although he got 63 million votes and not all of those voters were plutocrats. It's considered condescension to say that the base is ignorant and stupid. And in fact, that may be true because, as your anecdote tended to suggest, it's apparent that many in the base will not only be willing to endorse pain for themselves as long as they feel that the black and brown poor are enduring more pain, but also that they may perceive a kind of long game that many of us do not understand. That is to say, under apartheid South Africa, it was oftentimes suggested that sanctions would hurt the African majority. But the African majority was playing a long game, and they were willing to endure short-term pain for long-term gain. And I think that the Trump base is also playing a long game. That is to say that they are not plutocrats and oligarchs now, but perhaps they feel that they can become plutocrats and oligarchs in the future, particularly if the United States can loot and plunder Venezuela and Cuba and Iran and the rest of the world. I think it's also fair to say that many are reluctant to say that Make America Great Again, the Trump slogan, means returning to a day when Europeans off the boat could claim Native American land and have the possibility of enslaving Africans. It reminds me also of the U.S. Civil War, when the soldiers, the rank and file soldiers in the army of the so-called Confederate States of America, were not slave owners, and in fact, many of them were subjected to fierce job competition from enslaved Africans that were driving down their wage standards and living standards generally. But once again, they felt that if the Confederate States of America were to prevail, then they could aspire to be slave owners, and therefore they believed in slavery, just like this working class and middle class base of the Trump coalition apparently believes in plutocracy. What this suggests, of course, is that we have an enormous job of political and ideological education to perform. And until we do that, it seems to me that we'll always be suffering these kinds of setbacks, not only with regard to this abomination of a bill, but also with regard to what we'll be discussing shortly, that is to say, these midterm congressional elections or this special election that took place in Georgia just a few days ago.
Right. Thank you for that, Dr. Gerald Horn. And we are indeed going to go into that in our next segment. But why don't we take our station break now? And when we return, we'll continue with our panelists on our weekly roundtable. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
People keep on learning.
and the great Stevie Wonder's Higher Ground. We can only hope that we are moving towards a higher ground rather than the race to the bottom. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. You can check us out on SoundCloud. Just go to the SoundCloud website and look for Sojourner Truth with Margaret Prescott. And you could also check us out on our website at www.sotrueradio.org. And also, if you're a member of Facebook, you can like and friend us on Facebook. And today, I'd like to give a shout out to our listeners in the great state of Florida. It is our weekly roundtable, and our panelists are Laura Carlson, Jackie Goldberg, and Dr. Gerald Horn. And we are now going to shift our focus to what is going on with the Democratic Party. All of the special election that have been held so far, the Democrats have lost. And this past Tuesday's defeat, especially in Georgia's 6th district, was particularly devastating. A lot of people were really hoping, even though it was a majority Republican GOP district, that they were hoping that the young 30-year-old John Ossoff would pull it off in Georgia's 6th district. Georgia's 6th seat was held by Newt Gingrich and then by Tom Price, who is Trump's current Health and Human Services Secretary. And the Democrats had hoped that they could really peel that off and also to give an indication for the midterm elections coming up in 2018. They came close, but a loss is still a loss. Ossoff drew the first most votes in the first round of the race with 48% of the vote, but he was just a few thousand votes away from winning the seat outright. And then going into Tuesday's two-person runoff, his competition was Georgia Secretary of State Republican Karen Handel, and she came out winning by about 4 percentage points. Now, there's been a lot of hand-wringing and analysis going on about what happened, and within the Democratic Party, calls, particularly from some of the Blue Dog Dems, for Nancy Pelosi, the leader of the party in the House, to step down, with the hope that that will help to retool the Democratic Party. But earlier this week, I spoke with Peter Dreyer, professor of economics and chair of the Urban and Economic Environmental Policy Department at Occidental College, and he wrote an article in the Huffington Post, and he says that one factor that made a huge difference was low turnout among African Americans, a similar story that happened to Hillary. Because that also happened in Michigan, in Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania, where the Democrats lost to Donald Trump. Now, it's not the only reason, but it is a key reason. And I frankly don't know if that penny has dropped with the Democrats and really what they intend to do about it, or just continue business as usual, where at the last minute they drop in some organizers in the Black community hoping to draw people out. Similarly, could be true, said of the Brown community as well. So, Laura Carlson, your view on what is going on here? I mean, the Democrats, they haven't really been able to pull any of this out. Laura Carlson.
It's easy to criticize a loss. If Ossoff had won in Georgia, the Democrats and progressives would be congratulating themselves about the strategy. But I think it was always a mistake. This was a Republican stronghold. It was an uphill battle. And most of all, I think it was a mistake to go for a model of outside support in an exemplarily local election as a means of kind of changing the national narrative. What it means is that it makes elections much more expensive. This was an election that there was $40 to $50 million for this seat involved, more than $25 million just for Ossoff's campaign. Is that really where we want to be dedicating our resources? And it means that you're doing that instead of doing the local grassroots work of preparing for a different kind of society and a different outcome in elections in general across the country. You're also lining the pockets of the mainstream media, who are clearly part of the problem and not the solution for U.S. democracy. So I think they set themselves up for a very visible loss. And the fact that also went to a more centrist positions in many cases probably has a lot to do with a low turnout among their core. So the one of the lessons of this Georgia election was that, first of all, what we already sort of knew, that the core, the Trump core and the Republican Party core is pretty much immobile, and they're pretty much immune to any kinds of arguments coming from outside their tradition and from outside their very deep loyalties. And then on the other hand, if you don't get out the Democratic core because you're moving toward trying to seduce part of that Trump Republican core, you end up losing that as well.
Right. And thank you for that, Laura Carlson. And Jackie Goldberg, and Peter Dreyer also in his article says the Democrats need to win a net of 24 seats to have a majority in the House, and that Clinton beat Trump in 23 House districts that were won by Republican candidates for the House. But I wonder what your thoughts are on what this might mean for the midterm elections, and frankly speaking, what you think the Democrats need to be doing right now. I don't know that going after Nancy Pelosi is necessarily the answer. I was frankly a bit more concerned about the head of the DNC, where the Bernie candidate, Keith Ellison, lost to the Obama candidate, and I think that really let down a lot of the young Bernie-crats, so to speak, who were enthusiastic about making some change in the progressive direction in the Democratic Party. And one thing that the Republicans do very well is they stick together, even when they're wrong. Well, in my village, they used to say, you're wrong and strong, right? And there's a way in which people, it seems, really admire that as a show of strength, while the Democrats always seem to be, you know, nipping away at each other. Jackie Goldberg, your thoughts?
Well, you know, we always have that problem, but I think I agree with Laura entirely. We would have been much better off spending that money hiring organizers in all of the areas and locations where we're going to try to take out Republicans in the 2018 elections, and begin to have a massive education campaign, a massive organizing campaign. We could have hired a lot of organizers for that money and said, you know, that what we're going to be doing is being very careful to make sure that we are prepared in 2018. Instead, we blew a lot of money on a campaign that, in my opinion, you know, really had no real chance of winning. The only way they would have won, even if there had been larger African-American turnout and Latino turnout and young people turnout, the only way they would have won is as if the folks who are in Trump's base had abandoned him. And they're not ready to do that. He hasn't even been in office a full 6 months yet. They're not ready to abandon him. And we should assume they're not ready to abandon him, which means that we should be looking at those districts where there is a real chance of winning, and working right now to provide education and opportunity and organizing, setting up community-based organizations, helping them get ready for this election coming up. The only good news, and it is good news, is that in these four seats that the Democrats lost, they lost by very small amounts compared to what Trump had won. That does mean that there is a more activated Democratic base, but you can't rely on it. You must organize in it. You must educate in it. You must connect people to the issues, and you must run on issues that are relevant to the people who are there and not on some national platform, because all elections are local. I don't care what anybody says. All elections are local. And I don't think they behaved that way. And certainly the fact that they did not do major organizing in the black and brown communities, but instead tried to win over whites in suburban America who were already committed to Trump, I thought, what a foolish idea. that's not a way to win an election.
Yeah, and Dr. Gerald Horn, I mean, underscoring the point of race here, the context that we're dealing with is Civil Smith shot, killed by Milwaukee police officer, black police officer, by the way, last August, was found not guilty, right, of first-degree reckless homicide just this past Wednesday. The killer of Philando Castillo, a lot of which was caught on video that went viral, also was let out. And you have all kinds of hot spots to show the tensions of race in this country. And Evergreen State College, that became a kind of a hot spot of where people were making all kinds of comments because of some teachers apparently one day wore Black Lives Matter t-shirts. You had I think it was Trinity College, I'm not sure, I have to check that out, that literally had to close its doors because they were receiving bomb threats because one of their professors made some comment about being fed up with the racism of white people. And I think, Dr. Horn, all of this is really connected here. And just underscoring, there's an opinion piece in the New York Times by Thomas Edsel that says, it opens by saying that it's become clear that conservative parties in Europe and the U.S. have been gaining strength from white voters who have been mobilized around issues related to nationalism, with a resistance to open borders and to immigration from the global south. And they highlight the American National Election Studies that says Trump accelerated a realignment in the electorate around racism across several different measures of racial animus that helped him to win. They said that that was even more of a measure than economic distress. So, Dr. Horn, your take on this. The title, by the way, of that article is The End of the Left and the Right as We Know Them. Dr. Horn.
Well, I think your point actually helps to underscore the point I was trying to make earlier, which is that we have a massive job of political and ideological education ahead of us. For example, it's clear that the Democrats need to focus more on voter suppression of black and brown voters. But when you do that, many in the Trump base will cry that that's an illegitimate form of affirmative action, where even some of our liberal friends will claim that there's been a capitulation to so-called identity politics, whatever that might mean. And given that conundrum, it becomes clearer every day why it's so difficult to defeat the Republicans. On a more positive note, former Vermont Governor Howard Dean, in analyzing the vote in Georgia, said that he was upbeat about the vote because Tom Price, the Health and Human Services Secretary, who won that vote most recently for the GOP, won by a healthy double-digit total, whereas Kathy Handel, his successor as a Republican congressperson, won in the low single digits. And according to Howard Dean, if that kind of pattern is replicated nationally, it's inevitable that the Republicans will lose those 24 and 25 seats in 2018, and therefore will lose the speakership and lose the control of the House of Representatives. That may be overly optimistic, but I think that it can't not be dismissed out of hand. However, I do think that the folks in Southern California have a particular obligation. Orange County, you see four GOP congresspersons who should be on the ropes. I'm thinking of Daryl Benghazi Issa and Dana Cold War Rohrabacher and
right.
Mimi Walters and Ed Royce. Now, I know that the Democratic Party in California just had a raucous convention where there was sharp contestation between liberals and those to their left, but it seems to me that a focus on Orange County needs to be a particular obligation for the California Democratic Party, and indeed for other third parties as well in the state of California. I agree with you with regard to this focus on Nancy Pelosi. At the California Democratic Party convention, she would not necessarily be considered a group with those to the left of liberal. But the attack on her in Washington, D.C. is an attack from the right. It's not an attack from the left. They think that she's too progressive. That's why they want to get rid of her. And so it seems to me that that must be resisted, at least for the time being.
Right. And this is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. It's our weekly roundtable with our panelists, Laura Carlson, Jackie Goldberg, and Dr. Gerald Horn. And we are now going to turn our attention to international matters here. And they're so interconnected. Trumpgate, U.S. military attacks in Syria, support for isolating Qatar by Trump and the Gulf states, and the moves against Iran. Over the past few weeks, the U.S. has increased its military actions in the Middle East. Just this past June, the U.S. have shot down three aircrafts that are linked to the Assad government, Syria's Assad government. And most recently on Sunday, June 18th, U.S. troops shot down a pro-Syrian government drone and then released a statement claiming they do not seek to fight the Syrian regime, Russia, or pro-regime forces partnered with them, but would continue to defend the U.S.-led coalition against any threats. A lot of people, frankly, don't believe that story. Meanwhile, the Russian Ministry of Defense has now threatened to target any U.S. or coalition aircraft that travels west of the Euphrates River. And there's an uptick of U.S. military actions in the region. And alongside of that, you have Trump visiting Saudi Arabia, and shortly after that, the Saudis, along with other Gulf states, initiating a boycott of Qatar, which is not only an attempt to isolate Qatar, but also going after Iran. And of course, there's a huge gas field that's shared between Qatar and Iran. And one wonders if that has anything to do with this. And of course, the U.S. position seems confused, with Trump saying one thing and Secretary of State Tillerson saying something else. And now Qatar has been given a list of demands. Let's go to a clip from Al Jazeera. By the way, one of those demands is that Qatar shut down Al Jazeera, which is based out of Qatar. But let's go to that clip now.
The developments in this GCC crisis. We heard Sinem, our correspondent in Istanbul there, talk about this Turkish base and its significance. And a very important point she made is that this deal to set up this Turkish base in Qatar was made 2 years ago. So why are the UAE, Saudi Arabia and others demanding that they shut down this base now? What's the significance of this event?
I think initially when they started the embargo against Qatar, their aim was to further isolate Qatar and then ask Qatar for major concessions. It turned out to be the opposite. Mm-hmm. The isolation paved the way for something new, a new geopolitical order in the region with, for example, Turkey setting up a base and deploying troops here in Qatar, something that would raise massive concerns for Saudi Arabia and for the United Arab Emirates. Well, the Qatari government has been saying this is an issue of national sovereignty. We can have deals the same way that you can have military deals with different countries. Now, if you look at the set of demands put by the United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia, mm-hmm. there's a new development, which is Mohammed bin Salman taking over as the crown prince, and right. we know that he's the man with the ultimate say now in Saudi Arabia. Is he going to step in? This is a very critical moment for everyone in this part of the world. Mm. And critical moment also for Saudi Arabia, because the new crown prince faces massive challenges. War in Yemen, mm-hmm. the biggest political crisis in the region in decades. And he has a vision for his own country. But you can't move forward unless you solve those problems. And right. I think he will come under massive pressure to try to solve this. If you don't, you will have new reality in this part of the world.
Will there be pressure from Washington, you think? We heard there the State Department spokeswoman talk about reasonable and actionable in relation to these demands made by Qatar. That was yesterday, mm-hmm. of course. But we did hear at the beginning of the crisis a different tone from President Trump himself. What is going to be the U.S. reaction to these demands?
Well, the United States of America is divided over this issue. The White House has provided a blanket support for Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. The State Department and the Defense Ministry seem to be more balanced in their approach. However, they do understand that further escalation in the region is bad news for the United States of America in terms of the fight against ISIL in Iraq and in Syria. Mm-hmm. You cannot further alienate one of their biggest allies in the region, where you have one of the most important military base and forward operation.
All righty. So there you go. And, you know, Laura Carlson, try as I did try. It's really difficult to untangle the Russia Trump gate story, what's happening with Saudi Arabia and Syria, Qatar, and Iran, well, not to mention Israel and Palestine. I mean, it really is a piece of a whole right now. And one concern that the peace movement, although it's relatively quiet these days, has about what's going on is the stepped up U.S. military activity in Syria. There's been no declaration of war, but there you have the U.S. shooting down the planes of another government and, you know, setting things up for a conflict with Russia, while at the same time, you've got this bromance or whatever you want to call it going on between Trump and Putin. But and also the fact that there's a huge U.S. military base in Qatar, while Trump and others seem to be backing the Saudi and the Arab nations, saying that Turkey, there shouldn't be a military base for Turkey in Qatar. So you have a double standard, but it really is all of one piece, and with a view very much also to isolating Iran. Your take on all of this, Laura?
What is connected, and it's all a big mess. And again, I would start out by warning that trying to find any underlying logic or overall strategy in this Trump government regarding all of these issues is a futile exercise, because all the indications that we have, from the contradictions between Trump himself and Tillerson, and from the different moves with different countries that are apparently, not only apparently, but actually contradictory, indicates that there's a high degree of confusion and of ignorance in terms of what's happening here. All the events that you mentioned, the shooting down of the Iranian drones, the increased attacks in Syria, the rumbling threats against Iran, and the isolation of Qatar, appear to be provocation. In that sense, I'm not entirely in agreement with the previous commentator on the clip that there's a clear understanding within the U.S. government that escalation of hostilities is bad. There seems to be a current within the U.S. government that is for escalating hostilities. Otherwise, you couldn't explain what's happening now. We're once again talking about a sovereign nation that poses no conceivable threat to the United States, and we're talking about an undeclared war that implies multiple violations of international law and is, by the way, exactly what Donald Trump promised he would not do under his government. So there is a provocation there. Achieving exactly the opposite of what anyone would have meant to achieve with Qatar, in the sense that they have reinforced alliances with Iran and others in self-protection. And now Tillerson requires this list of demands, and the demands come out, and they're ridiculous.
Right. And Jackie Goldberg, apologies to you, because we're going to go now to actually Dr. Gerald Horn, who I know has been following this very closely. I know you are as well, Jackie, but I just want to give Gerald the time that he needs to really give his thoughts on this. Thank you, Jackie. Dr. Horn.
Well, first of all, with regard to the gas fields, the sanctions against Qatar, which is a major exporter of gas, has complicated their ability to fulfill contracts in Europe. At the same time, the new Russian sanctions bill just passed by Congress will make it difficult for Russia as well to fulfill its contracts with Europe as well. So what that means is that U.S. natural gas producers can now fill that gap, and we need an enterprising journalist to find out who controls U.S. natural gas fields and who do they donate to politically. I've never seen in recent days so many reflections on the possibility of World War III, which is quite frightening. It's not only what you mentioned with regard to Russia backing its ally in Damascus. It's also the fact that NATO exercises are taking place on Russia's border, that the president of Ukraine was just in the Oval Office with Donald J. Trump, and war in Ukraine is heating up on Russia's western border. You had the plane of the Russian defense minister buzzed by NATO jets just a few days ago.
That's right.
As ISIS is being squeezed in Syria, there is the prospect of the United States confronting Iran, Hezbollah, Damascus, and Russia, at the same time that France, under new President Macron, has just flipped, saying that the exit of President al-Assad from Damascus is not a condition precedent to a settlement in Syria, which puts even more pressure on Washington to relax its anti-Damascus position. But I don't think that that will necessarily occur. And in any case, keep your eye on July 4th, 2017, not only the U.S. national holiday, but President Xi Jinping will be meeting with President Putin in Moscow on that date, and I do not find that accidental or coincidental.
Right, and underscoring the rise of Mohammed bin Salman as the crown prince in Saudi Arabia, 31 years old, and he has been the mastermind behind that horrific war happening now in Yemen. So we'll keep an eye on that as well. But another fascinating roundtable. We are out of time. I'd like to thank all of today's guests and today's show produced by Margaret Prescott. I'd like to thank the entire Sojourner Truth team, our assistant producer, Stephanie Case, our intern, Sherelle Withers, and Mr. T. Teddy Robinson. If you'd like a copy of today's show, please contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230 or go online to Pacifica Radio Archives. Thank you for listening. This is your host, Margaret Prescott.